Okay, thank you. So agenda paper one, we've received a number of submissions that discuss a situation in which an incurred claim under an insurance contract creates insurance risk for the entity that wouldn't exist if the claim weren't made. So an example would be where you've got insurance coverage for disability that provides an annuity for the period in which a policyholder becomes disabled. So if the policy makes if the policyholder makes a valid disability claim, he's entitled to an annuity. The annuity creates insurance risk for the entity which would not exist if no disability claim were made. So the submissions ask whether the entity's obligation to pay amounts subsequent to an incurred claim that are subject to insurance risk, whether those obligations should be treated as a liability for incurred claims or as a liability for remaining coverage. The classification of the obligation as either a liability for incurred claims or as a liability for remaining coverage doesn't affect the determination of the fulfilment cash flows, but it does affect the determination of the coverage period, and hence it affects whether some changes in the fulfilment cash flows adjust the contractual service margin, and it affects the allocation of the contractual service margin. So in the paper, paragraphs 15 and 16 set out alternative analyses of the requirements of IFRS 17 applied to two examples. One of the examples is the disability cover that gives rise to annuity. The other is insurance for the cost of rebuilding a house after a fire. And we thought it was useful to look at two examples like this because it shows sort of the range of products that could be affected by this question. We think that both analyses in the paragraphs are valid interpretations of IFRS 17 for both examples. We observe that the approach then that's applied by an entity is an accounting policy choice as defined in IAS 8. So we think that an entity should apply whichever approach it chooses consistently for similar transactions and over time. And then I would like to ask your views on the analysis in the paper.
Okay, thanks, Anne. Anybody? JP?
Thank you, Martin. Good morning, everyone. I agree on the staff's view that identifying the obligation into LRC or LIC is a matter of judgment, in that there are now different practices regarding classification criteria being used by insurers and by jurisdictions. As long as insurers apply consistently the same classification criteria for the obligation, I think it won't create any comparability between insurers. In Korea, now most life insurers are classifying them as LRC, whereas non-life insurers are classifying as LIC, reflecting their own business nature and business strategy. And also, as far as I am aware of, in the US, disability annuities are classified as LIC, while most Asian insurers classified as LRC. Different practices exist. Apparently, I think that the insurers want to maintain their own current accounting policy, if possible, which would lessen their burden to prepare for IFRS 17. In that sense, I support staff's view on letting insurers to choose their accounting policy on classification criteria. Thank you.
And?
Thanks, Martin. I think, to be fair, we hadn't picked up on this interpretation issue in Australia. We had assumed it was the liability for incurred claims approach. So it was interesting to see this, and I think collectively we identified a couple of products in the market where this the LFRC approach would be probably a better way to go. So we value the optionality that's in here, or the choices we can make. Two things I wanted to bring out. One is in paragraph 17, it talks about the two things that would influence your judgment. One is relative complexity, and one is comparability with other products, in particular if the consequential claim is available as a standalone product. And I think that gave quite a bit of cause cause for concern, because when, certainly from a general insurance perspective, when you're looking at how you would, which choice you would make, you'll be looking at how you underwrite the product and the product that you are selling and the risk that you're undertaking. And this is only one, the how you settle the claim in the end is only one component of that. So we felt that those two were quite narrow judgments that you'd have to make, and actually an overriding one is what product am I selling into what market? And if you think about it, if you're writing globally, you could be selling a similar product in different markets where the claim settlement has just got a different nature that wouldn't necessarily change the product you're selling. So a caution on 17, that I thought that was a very narrow sort of set of judgments. And then the other point I'd like to raise is on paragraph 21, which is where you'll potentially go back later and relook at this if there's diversity in practice. If you're, general insurers were largely using the PAA approach, you can get a very significantly different outcome if you have to swap from a liability from incurred claims approach to the liability for remaining coverage approach, because that could change your coverage period significantly. So we don't want an IFRS 17 Mark II happening in a few years' time. So just caution around that, that it's very important that companies are allowed to choose the approach which best fits their business model and not be affected by the fact that a standalone product would be available elsewhere. That's it.
Okay, but when the paper is saying that this judgment should be influenced, it's not saying, okay, that is the only two criteria.
But it only gives two criteria.
Yeah, but it says that the main judgment is which approach provides the most useful information. So these are just factors that would influence that judgment about what is the most useful. So the principal is thinking about what is the most useful information.
Yeah, and that is a common theme under IFRS, okay, if you choose policy, right? Yeah. Mary?
And I think just to underscore some of the points that Anne has made and also that Anne from the staff has made, I think what requires careful study is the nature of the products that are being offered around the world. Because there are some products that have got distinct features. I think the answer is you need to study your products carefully, then work out what provides the most useful information on the insurance service provided, and you then apply your accounting policy. It's not an accounting policy choice that you go one way or the other. You need to work out what's the nature of the service being provided and then apply your accounting policies. But we welcomed this because it does reflect the diversity of different product types found around the world.
Okay, thanks, Mary. Kevin?
I had a similar point to Mary where, the first time when this came out and I was talking to people, there was some concern about, is it really an accounting policy choice or is it more about applying facts and circumstances and looking at the standard? But I think having gone back and reread your paper, I think you are saying it's about facts and circumstances, you look into it, and if when you look into it there's a valid argument either way, you make a choice and you disclose that. And so I think that's really valid. One of the things I was just thinking about yesterday was we had those examples in the February and May TOG about how to earn the CSM. And I remember one of them was about building insurance, where basically you cover the building period, and then if a defect arises in the next 10 years, you will pay them. And I think there was quite a firm answer as to what the coverage period was. So it might be worth just going back and looking at those examples in the light of this paper and saying, I guess in some cases, you probably have answer A or answer B, both of which were valid. So in that one, you either earn the CSM over 1 year or you earn it over 10 years. I think we'd come down firmly on one or the other in that paper. But like Mary and others, I'm supportive of the paper.
Okay, Gail.
Thank you. We also would agree with the staff summary here. So when we had our internal discussions, we had concluded both views were in the standards. So we had got to the same place. I guess I would echo what someone else said. There is a concern that if you come back in a few years' time and change the view, that has massive operational implications for those who've taken the more simple approach, who then may have to in the future. And I guess it will lead to diversity, as we've just heard, because I think people will follow what they're currently doing. I think it's quite clear, though, coming back to this accounting policy choice, we are looking at IS8, and I think that's really important, because I have heard some people thinking that because they can follow, there is diversity and it's and there are choices, they can almost do what they're doing today. But I think we need to be very clear that IS8 would require a consistent policy to be applied to consistent products. So if the product is the same in geographic different locations, I think it has to be consistent. And I have heard some people not believing that's what the words say.
So,
Gail pretty much said what I was going to just point out, because a couple of people have, you know, commented on whether or not it is an accounting policy or not. And I think the staff analysis, an important part of it for me was the conclusion that it was an accounting policy, because then we do have these very specific requirements that Gail was referring to in IAS 8 that are then relevant. It's not just including consistency over time, and if you were to change, you need to meet the normal requirements for an accounting policy change. So I think for us that's actually important.
Yeah. So, John?
Thanks, Sue, for that clarification, because I also have a concern as to comments raised earlier by Mary and others about the accounting policy choice, because we feel that, you know, there shouldn't be too much optionality. But we acknowledge that each contract should be assessed case by case, taking into account the facts and circumstances, apply the accounting appropriate accounting principle, depending on the situation. Having said that, we note that in this particular case, the fact patterns provided are based on one single event, for disability income, is one single incident or illness here, with no remaining coverage for subsequent events. So this is a simplified fact pattern for many disability income products, because more complicated cases, you could have multiple claims arising. Based on this, we are in favor of view one, which is explained in paragraph 15. We think this principle should be applied to other contracts where the ultimate claims amount is uncertain. For example, you have medical reimbursement, hospitalization income, things that will give rise to multiple claims. Another point I want to point out is our Hong Kong equivalence of TRG discussion, there were a concern, similar concern as to one raised by Anne regarding having the view two explained in paragraph 16 because of that issue with PAA.
Okay, thanks. William?
Thank you. This particular topic is one that's been around for several years, at least from an actuarial standpoint. It's one of the first things that we looked at least in North America, Europe, maybe not Australia, but and I definitely agree with the staff's conclusion on this topic, that it is an accounting policy choice. My observation, it will be similar to JP's in the sense that companies will probably be looking to do what they currently do, their current accounting policy, which is primarily driven by, in my observation, regulatory requirements today for accounting for these types of products, which will vary by jurisdiction, obviously. But I would expect that for similar products in a similar jurisdiction, you would get some comparability around the treatment of whether it's an A or B option.
Yeah, thanks, William. Francesco?
Thank you. I have to express a less positive view than those who have spoken before me about this conclusion of the staff in the paper. I know that there are mixed views around in the market, so it's a very valid submission, those who made it and brought a relevant problem on the application of IFRS 17. I noted that this is the first time that actually the staff gives us this type of answer. And I was surprised by that, because the fact pattern that you have that has been described in the paper would appear to me to lead more clearly towards a view B expressed in the paper, that is effectively a liability for incurred claims. That also carries with it a much reliable application of IFRS 17. What I'm concerned is that there are two possibilities here as a result of the application of judgment. The first one is that there are inconsistent application of the same product even in the same market. Because at that point, when IFRS 17 arrives, it is a new accounting standard. There is nothing that is going to stop entities, given what they are going to read in this paper, to form their judgment and depart or stay with existing practices. I hear some people saying that the existing practices will be an important reference and people will stick to them. I'm not as confident that this is going to be the case. In fact, IFRS 17 is going to reopen entirely the financial reporting processes of insurance companies. And so the fact that today in country X they do it that way and country Y they do it that way doesn't mean that when they adopt IFRS 17 they will stick to that. Actually, quite the contrary, in my opinion. The second problem that I see is that with this new concept, which I don't actually agree with the staff, is implicit in B5, of consequential insurance risk, we are effectively reopening completely the accounting for short-term coverage contracts, because now we have effectively a basis where any short-term insurance company could, based on this paper, say, well, the claim has now happened, but I'm still protecting the policyholder somehow by effectively having this consequential insurance risk. That means that there could be general insurance companies that actually, on purpose, may actually conclude that this is the case in their contracts, others that will not. And we have not only the life insurance companies with diversity, we also have general insurance companies with diversity. And that, in my opinion, is not helping IFRS 17 become the basis for improvement in the transparency, in particular, of the profit emergence of insurance companies. The other concern I have is that this creates also some practical implication in terms of the complexity of the systems that people will have to develop to accommodate their particular judgment. Because if you have two different types of coverage, arguably you could say that there are two different types of coverage units, one that applies when there is no claim and then the other one that is effectively triggered by when the incurred claims happens and you have this consequential insurance risk starting. Then you have to stop it because the policyholder may have may been rehabilitated and the cure has worked out and so you can go back to work and all that kind of stuff. Having the liability for incurred claims doesn't actually trigger that complexity. So not having complexity, having a clear approach on the same fact pattern to me would have been far more preferable. And I personally would have been in the camp of those supporting view B as the outcome of the analysis, but I see that probably there will be a minority of one so far, at least on that point.
Could I just ask, do you think that the analysis in paragraph 16 that's saying you could interpret IFRS 17 as saying it's the liability for remaining coverage, do you disagree with the analysis of those of how we've interpreted the words, or are you just saying that you prefer the other view?
No, I disagree with the analysis of using B5 for the creation. So to me, the consequential insurance risk is not a concept that is justified in the literature of IFRS 17, unless you are actually transferring it by effectively issuing a contract. And that's what paragraph B5 was written about, is when you have insurance risk arising from expired coverages, and you are insuring that risk to somebody else.
But if you look at the way we've interpreted, like, the definition of an insured event and the coverage period in paragraph 16, you think that's a flawed, the way we've analysed it is not right somehow?
That's right. So I believe that with this analysis, effectively, we are creating fusion as to when there is an insured event occurring, because one company may say, actually, that's not an incurred claim. It's just the beginning of a new coverage. Another one will say, no, actually, that's an incurred claim. And the products could be the same in the same country. It could be two competitors. And that, to me, is not helping the users of the financial statements then to see what it is that the two companies are doing.
So in your view, you read the words only one way?
I think that the paper tried to illustrate that we can read the definitions, not B5. We didn't provide an analysis based on B5. We provide analysis based on the words and the definition of insured event and coverage period. We could read, and we need to be honest with our analysis, we could read the words different ways. I think that what you point out about the possibility of abuse is always out there. We cannot do standard setting based on that possibility. I think we made it clear that when you make an accounting policy decision, you need to consider all facts and circumstances, the nature of the product, as was said here. And I think that that is a good enough start for this paper. Always, I think the board will monitor, as if any other type of standard, diversity in practice. But at this point, I think it's a good starting point, but that is my view.
Okay, thanks. Leslie?
Excuse me, but I'm confused about whether this is an accounting policy choice or not, or whether I heard different people saying different things, but even though they seem to be agreeing. So I think when I was reading the paper, I was also confused, because on the one hand, it seemed to tell me that I needed to choose the one that gave the most useful information, which would, to me, suggest facts and circumstances. But then it said it was an accounting policy choice, which only requires, really, that I choose something consistent within my company. I was a little worried about how consistency with Francesco's point about consistency with competitors, and I would hope that within the Canadian market we would try to stay on the same page. But I think, on listening to this discussion, my confusion about whether it's really an accounting policy choice or not has not been resolved.
Darren?
So, do you want to?
No, you go.
I was going to, and I did worry a little bit that people were talking across purposes. The way I've been thinking about it is the accounting policy that you develop is for specific facts and circumstances that arise, you will treat them this way. For different facts and circumstances that you arise, you'll treat them a different way. And I think it's developing the policy to understand what those facts and circumstances are that would cause you to treat it as LIC, and what facts and circumstances cause you to treat it as LRC. So I think the policy choice is what informs how you react to the facts and circumstances that you see. And so I think both are part of the answers, the way I would have thought of this.
Could I just, I think I'm saying the same thing. What I would say is it is an accounting policy choice, but in making an accounting policy choice, you think about what is the best accounting policy given the facts and circumstances. You need to choose a policy that provides useful information. So you think about, given the facts and circumstances and nature of the product and everything else, what gives the most useful information?
Azuka.
I echo what was said, and I am in principle in agreement with the analysis that the staff has put into the paper about the accounting policy choice and about the need to look into the specific facts and circumstances of a product. I think if I had an element of slight unease into the analysis, it is in the example with the fire insurance. And again, thinking and going back to some of the examples in the papers that we've discussed in the past in the context of coverage units, when we were talking about the fact that it is the ability for a valid claim that largely in quite a lot of the cases will determine, what I was thinking in the case of the short-term fire contract, you cannot make a valid claim beyond the expiry of the legal contract. So that's why I was slightly uneasy about an analysis that was going beyond that and bringing in a coverage period there. Because I believe that if the policyholder cannot make a valid claim, anything, that is an insurance risk beyond that point is to do with the settlement, and it will be captured via the risk adjustment of the liability for incurred claims. So that's what I wanted to kind of flag.
Okay. Jens?
I fully agree that there's an accounting policy choice that is limited by the restrictions in IAS 8. However, I do echo a little bit what has been said earlier. Where I struggled is, especially for the fire insurance, where I think that reading the analysis, I was pushed towards LIC, was fire insurance, and I was thinking that it would be helpful for the paper if we say there's a policy choice, that we provide at least one example where we say there is no either this view or that view, but it's rather for this particular example, we have only an LIC or an LRC, and stating that we can rule out a free choice and provide a concrete answer to a concrete fact pattern. I think this would be helpful, more helpful than provide, because these are simplified fact patterns, and I do think for these simplified fact patterns, there's some sympathy for coming to either LIC or LRC, and then if we come and can conclude that at least for one fact pattern, it is clear and it's not a free choice, but rather if you have this particular fact pattern, you would end up with, for me, the fire insurance is an LIC example, so I would have then, I think this would help understanding the paper and reduce the risk of broad interpretation of what has been said in the paper, because we fully acknowledge that there is a policy choice that should be applied in the sense of IS 8, but this is not a do as you like. It's rather there are facts and circumstances that need to be considered. But just a proposal.
Gail?
Can I just come back on Darrell's point, because I want to be very clear that we're not talking at cross purposes, because I think we may still be. So whilst I wish I could get to where Jens and Francesco are, I'm not sure I can read the words in the standard to say there is only one way, much as I would prefer there were. So I think it is an accounting policy choice. And I understand the facts and circumstances, but to be very clear, if we have, let's cut to the chase, if we have a motor policy in two different countries, and it's the same product, you crash your car, you get paid some money, or you get an annuity for the person you've killed or seriously wounded, it's got to be accounted for the same, because I am concerned when I hear people saying they want to do existing accounting policies, it's based on regulatory, they'll carry on doing what they're doing. I think in that instance, the facts and circumstances are it's the same. The fact you're doing it differently today and under local regulatory is irrelevant. It is the same contract, and I think we would need to be under IS 8 doing it consistently. I think that's what the staff and the board are saying, but I'm not sure we're all understanding that, so I just want to clarify that.
I agree, because when IS 8 has a different meaning under IFRS 17 compared to what it is currently under 4, because when that was a kind of exemption to have consistent policies, and you cannot say, oh, in the past I have used it in different regions, different regulatory treatments. Now IS 8 says, okay, if you have
policy.
Same product, same circumstances, you have to apply it consistently, and that is, I think, a big change. Roman.
Yeah, I of course agree to what the chair says, but I cannot fully echo, I think, what Dale and Jens said. First of all, I don't think it's a good idea that here in the TRG we develop a very specific fact pattern and then do a decision what is a relevant accounting policy. I think that would go beyond what is possible and also what the standard requires. I think ultimately the reality is always more complex and has more perspective than a paper can reflect on. So there will be management judgment going into the assessment according to the criteria the staff is also referencing here, and which finally also coming from IS 8. And that judgment, the TRG cannot apply. So I would not support that we go into this direction. And I also don't think that you can so easily say, okay, there's a motor product in country A and B, and if it's the same product, you need to come to the same conclusion. I agree, in most of the cases, that should be the case. But going through also the staff analysis and the points, I think we should evaluate, for example, the, if there are other products in the market available on a standalone basis. Could be that the product landscape in two markets is different. So there are the extreme and not and rare circumstances where you can come to the conclusion that the product, given the overall environment, is a different one in two markets, even then within one company. I would not say this is an inconsistent accounting policy. I'm not saying that this is a free choice, to be very clear, but just that we get then the summary in the right way, that not saying, okay, same products in all countries need to be treated always the same way. That would be the assumption I have by setting an accounting policy for my group. But then if the facts and circumstances differ and vary, then, of course, you can come to different conclusions as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Joe?
Hi, yeah. So I largely agreed with the staff analysis and the conclusions. I thought what was slightly confusing, was the point around the fire insurance. Which is why I think I'm in agreement that we're, you know, it's first of all, what's the most useful information, then what's the facts and circumstances, and then what's your accounting policy. I think it's not clear in the paper. My dividing line, and I would agree it's very much a matter for judgment, is, you know, are you providing ongoing cover? So if you're on the fire point, if your policy is saying, I will, if it's two things, one is I'll pay the cost if there's any fire that's occurred, and secondly, if you've had a fire, I will pay for any adverse development on the rebuilding cost. I think the second is in liability for remaining coverage. I think once you've had a fire, all the costs associated with that event are liability for incurred claims. And I think that's the dividing line, and it will depend on the terms of the contract and what it is you're providing. But I think that might be what you're saying, but I think that bit of the paper is confusing, and I think that's...
I'm struggling to, I think, understand the distinction you're making between, you're going to settle a claim and the amount of the claim is uncertain. How is that different from coverage for adverse development of a claim? To me, that sounds like the same thing.
So one is, if you have a fire, I'll pay all the costs. Second is, you have already had a fire. And the insurance risk I'm taking from you is the cost of settling that is worse than you think it is now. Or any adverse development in the cost. I think that's a different thing. In the first situation, if it's just a fire, in my reserving, I'm allowing for in the risk adjustment for, you know, the risk that the cash flows could be worse.
And would you apply that analysis as well to a disability claim that has an annuity? So you'd say that whenever you've got an initial claim, anything after that is liability for incurred claims?
Yes.
Does that mean that you don't agree with the way that we've interpreted the definitions in IFRS 17 in paragraph 16, which it's, as Francesco was saying...
So I think if you, and we would write, or, you know, becoming disabled, there could be, depending on the contract and what you're actually covering, if you become disabled and you put in a claim for income protection, you could have you're just covering that income for the next month, or, you know, for this particular reason that you're unable to work, you're covering income protection for that period. You're also providing ongoing coverage because you might get better from that and you might subsequently be sick again.
So that's a separate thing.
Yeah. Can I ask you a question? Because I think what I'd be interested in hearing your view, and I think you said it a little bit in the way you started talking about it. Are you describing what your policy would be in interpreting the requirements in the standard? In other words, intuitively, I probably get to the same answer as you. It feels like one is more than the other.
Yeah,
but are you describing what your policy would likely be, or are you describing something in the words that actually forces you to make the distinction you're talking about?
I'm describing IFRS 17 as I understand it.
Okay, so you would say the words would force you to make that distinction you talked about?
Judgment, yes.
Okay. Based on usefulness of information, or based on something more direct in the words?
I think it's the facts and circumstances and what we are liable for.
Okay. And as that we had a little bit of cream, now we...
Don't need to touch the mics, they're on all the time.
Okay. I think that this is an area where... I appreciate the fact that there is no a mandatory review in the paper, in the sense that the reality can be complex and potentially narrowing to oblige a precise model about the two views may create more troubles than given the flexibility of setting the accounting treatment that best fits with the facts and circumstances and sometimes with the business model. This doesn't mean that you may do what you want, because personally my view is that if I had to set an accounting policies for this kind of example, I would naturally prefer the view A, that is more, to me, is more consistent with high personal ECD application of IFRS 17 in front of claims. But we have evidence that, especially on the health insurance, like also Sei Chong said, we may have a reality that is very complex. Mm-hmm. And so I would leave the possibility that in presence of particular effects and circumstances, particular characteristic of the product, also the other model may be applied.
Okay, thanks, Massimo. Leslie?
Just picking up on Gail's comment, I just wanted to make sure you were only talking within a company.
Within a reporting entity.
Within a reporting entity, and I appreciate Roman's nuances with respect to that when you have a complex organization. But I just wanted to double check that you weren't implying that the same product would necessarily be treated the same way in two different entities.
No, I was applying IS 8 consistent accounting policies within a reporting entity.
Not to get so wrong, but I think, man, if you are in a company reporting entity, if it's a consolidated whatever, man, if you have clearly it's the same product and you have to choose accounting policy, you have to choose the same policy for the same product. You cannot say, okay, my company is now a little bit more complex, so I'm go away with
no,
it.
I didn't mean
that is
that.
Not how I read IS 8. IS 8 is saying, okay, if it is the same product, you should apply it consistently, and consistently means if it is the same product, you should have a consistent treatment.
And the use of the word same, I agree. I think the only comment, the only thing Roman was adding is that there, it's not always exactly the same. Yeah.
Maybe Sue can help also.
I guess I was just going to make a plea. I'm a bit worried that we're turning into a TRG discussing IS 8.
Yeah. Yeah.
And there's massive knock-ons beyond the TRG if we start doing that. So I guess if we could agree at the TRG that the analysis was that it's an accounting policy choice and then refer to IS 8, therefore being relevant, I'd be a much happier person.
I was going to suggest exactly the same.
Okay, thanks, Sue. Francesco?
I want to pick up on that because I didn't read there was a choice. So ISA always applies when you have to implement a standard. To me, the discussion has now taken a completely new dimension, but I want to check with the ISB staff. What they've written to me is not implying a choice. A choice under ISA means that there is a standard telling you you can use amortized cost or provider P&L, and I can choose one or the other. I didn't see anything of that kind in this paper. To me, there is application of judgment, and you accept that as you apply the judgment because of the analysis you've done, which I don't agree with, but you say based on that, the outcome of the application of that could be different.
I mean, paragraph 19 does say we observe that we think the approach applied is an accounting policy. So the choice of the approach is an accounting policy choice. That is what we were
getting. I agree with you, man. If it is an accounting policy choice, if we all agree with that, I think we're referring to IS 8 and the rules in IS 8, and I agree with you, should not give guidance or interpretation how to do IS 8 because it's not the purpose of.
Can I check if I understood what Francesco was asking? Because I suspect it might have been something different if I'd understood it. So there's sort of two things. Does the standard provide you with an explicit choice between these two? You're right, it doesn't. There's nothing in the standard that says you have a choice. The standard provides you, I think the analysis that the staff did says that the standard provides you with an implicit choice because it has been silent on which of the two options you can follow. And I think that might be the answer I think you were trying to understand.
No, absolutely. So to me, there is no choice. choice is only when I got two things I can choose from. Otherwise, it's what the staff, what I read in this paper, it is not a choice. It says you have to apply the judgment against the guidance of IFRS 17 to conclude what is the best application of those requirements.
So I think the use of the word choice might be confusing. You need to determine the appropriate accounting policy that you apply according to IS 8. People, when they talk about choice, they think of free choices or choices that are explicit in standards. There is no explicit choice in IFRS 17 in this respect. Therefore, you go to, and according to this analysis, you need to go to IS 8 to determine your accounting policy that is based on facts and circumstances and everything that was said here, and obviously applied consistently to similar facts and circumstances. So I think once you know adding choice to the discussion, people see that differently.
It's not an accounting option.
Anything to add on this?
A policy, accounting policy choice, but it's not an accounting option.
Yes,
I think the important point then is, as a consequence, the requirements of IS 8 about accounting policies are applicable.
Exactly.
But they apply all the time. I don't see this as a special case. I don't know why we're discussing it.
It's a reminder because of the conversation we're having about how much of a free choice it is, whereas why consistency.
Okay, Sten. I think, can you?
Okay, so I think we are agreed that at least most people agree that the words in IFRS 17 could be read in either way, and that therefore means that when you're thinking about determining your accounting policy, you think about, you apply IAS 8, you think about facts and circumstances, and applying IAS 8, you develop the best accounting policy for you, Sue.
You apply IS 8.
You apply IS 8. Okay, I'll go no further. You apply IS 8 in determining your accounting policy.
Okay. Thanks, Anne.
Determining and applying.
In determining and applying your accounting policy.
So then we go to the second topic, which is...
I need to walk or shower.
Theatre, and she has to swap